Yep, he's planning another project. So this Father's Day at Lowe's, tap into free gifts for dad. Get a free select Craftsman power tool when you buy a Craftsman V20 charger with 2 amp hour and 4 amp hour batteries. Plus, get a free DeWalt power tool when you buy a select 20 volt max XR 4 amp hour battery kit. Dad knows our best lineup is here at Lowe's. Valid through 7/14 while supplies last. Selection varies by location.
Good evening and welcome back to the Darkness on the Edge of Town Paranormal Radio Show. I'm your host, Dave Schrader. Today we have a special edition live from Crypticon out at the Radisson in Roseville. We've got a great thing going on out here, guys. Crypticon, it's a great horror movie convention. We've got a lot of celebrities out here. This evening we're taking the opportunity to also speak with some of the celebrities that are here and some of their actual ghost stories and weird tales of the paranormal. With me I have James Duvall, who is a star of, he was in Donnie Darko, he was in Independence Day, and I know my co-host and producer Tim here, he had the chance to talk to you a little bit yesterday and heard some of the stories. He's like, Dave, you got to talk to James, you got to get in there and talk to this guy. So why don't you start off a little bit, now first of all, you've been in some of the most fantastic movies.
Oh,
and
thank you.
Donnie Darko, that's pretty cool. I like the statue you have at your...
Thanks, a movie and a character like that, it only comes really once in a lifetime if you're really lucky, and you go through life without ever getting something like that. I mean, as far as acting goes, anyway. And so, to be a part of something like that, which is, if I wasn't in it, it would be one of my favorite movies, anyways. I'm in the stars about that film, actually.
Very cool. Now, you said that you're working on a new film, right, or you just got done with a new film, and you were having some really weird experiences on that as well. So why don't you tell us a little bit about the movie that's coming out and what happened to you?
Okay, yeah. I just recently finished a movie last year called Evolution, and the film is about the top secret scientist government experiment have discovered a life form, and the life form is kind of possesses people. It goes into their body and possesses them and creates kind of almost like zombies. We like to call them APLs, or alien possessed life forms. And so he believes that the life form can be reasoned with, so he takes the experiment and leaves the base, and he goes into an old hotel, you know, hiding out in the city to try to do more research and see if he can't break the code to calm or communicate with the alien species. Now, the hotel he breaks into, it turns out, is run by a sort of demon, sort of a character in the movie anyways. Now, the whole story revolves around that alien virus entity life form breaking out in the hotel, possessing people and wreaking havoc. Now, the interesting thing about this movie, beyond the, you know, the horror elements, I think, is the atmosphere and the environment that they had created, or shall I say that existed, when we already showed up to the set. We shot in a real hospital just east of downtown Los Angeles. It used to be called the Santa Fe Railroad Hospital. I forgot the name of it now. They're now converting it into lofts. It's a 5-story building. Beyond the emptiness and the eeriness and the coldness that when you walk in, there's abandoned old medical machines and lights and files from the 30s, 40s, and 50s. So whoever abandoned that hospital abandoned, like, they got out fast. They left stuff there. They didn't take it with them. And the interesting is, I did a little research because we heard it was haunted, you know, and of course it's like that tantalizes the imagination. So you're like, let's go find out what this is about. So we started to go in the hotel, or even before the hotel, we started to go online to read about it. And then someone was telling me, have you read the files in the file room? So you go back in the file room, and you put the pieces together from the internet that Santa Fe Railroad Hospital was for the railroad workers who couldn't afford normal medical care. So they would go there. Interestingly enough, you start going in the files, and people are dying from illnesses that they weren't being treated for. So that wasn't with their treatment in that hospital. Turns out they were experimenting on people in that hospital for years and years and years, and they were dying brutally. Now, when we started to shoot the film, we started to explore up there. And everyone can say, you know, I'm not afraid, blah, 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 okay, until you get up to the 4th floor by yourself in the dark, and nobody goes down that hallway. And there's a reason nobody goes down that hallway. So, we heard the 4th floor is the creepy unit. You know, it's all creepy, but the 4th floor is really where it's at. That's the old child's wing. So we went up with a camera. You know, I had certain digital cameras that can pick up the light spheres, you know, the entities. Went on the 1st floor, nothing. 2nd floor, nothing. 3rd floor, nothing. 5th floor, nothing. But the 4th floor, we get up there, take a couple pictures as soon as we get out of the elevator, nothing. Start walking down the hallway, taking pictures in rooms, going back and looking. Whoa, wait a minute. There's a light there. Wait, this room has three almost like lights that are hiding in corners. So we started to get kind of a little creeped out and started to walk back into the main, where the main check-in office would be for that floor. And when we got there and started taking pictures, all the lights started coming out of the doors into the hallway, coming towards us.
Wow.
And I have photo evidence of this. It's crazy. And the thing is, people say, oh, digital cameras and this. Okay, why is it only that floor and no other floor where there's absolutely no light? Can't say it's the dust because they all have dust. And to make it even more interesting beyond the pictures, one time we were finishing a scene and there's two wings to the hospital, and we were shooting in one wing and the wardrobe and dressing rooms were in another wing. So we go into this wing and there's huge steel doors that are being held up by cinder blocks. And I remember just walking down with the other actors. There's nobody in the building. They're all in the other building shooting. We're in between shots, so only him and I had to go back to change wardrobe. And as we walk down the hallway and we pass those doors, no sooner than maybe 10 paces from it, all the lights go out, the doors slam shut, the bricks flipped. There was no one in there but us.
So after you changed your underwear, what did you do?
Well, I was kind of still at the time, because I hadn't seen it. I knew there wasn't a logical explanation for it, but I just kept telling myself that. So I was kind of even more intrigued by the place. I was less confident to go up to the fourth floor at this point. Was not going to do that by myself anymore. Where it really got the most interesting was a manifestation that I had not seen, but I completely believed the woman who saw it, our wardrobe, because in the middle of a shot, she came, they actually were shooting a scene and they said, you know, wardrobe, you need to go back to wardrobe in the separate wing where the dressing rooms and all that stuff is. So she was by herself. You need to go in that room and you get this jacket for the actor. So she goes in the room, she comes back convulsing, crying, pale, freaked out, couldn't talk for about 15 or 20 minutes. By the time she talked, apparently when she walked in the room, a disemboweled head came out of the floor and stared at her. And she lost it. And everybody else on the set kind of really began to get creeped out now for the first time, like in a really big way.
Now, let's, for listeners again, I know we have ghost hunters all over the United States. We're going to start pounding the keyboard, Googling. Where is the name of this?
It's Santa Fe Railroad Hospital. And it's a new hospital now. I don't remember the name of it now, but it'll still come up as Santa Fe Railroad Hospital in Los Angeles.
Wow, so this was in there. Now, had you had any experiences prior to this with the paranormal?
Actually, yes, interestingly enough. I shouldn't say it was like a direct experience again. It's sort of an indirect experience, but it's more of a, you know, for me, a feeling or an emotion. I'm sure anyone who is listening to this, as well as yourself, when you begin to hear this, will realize the gravity of the situation. I've been offered years and years ago, right after Trent Reznor did the Broken EP, to come up to his house, because he shot videos for it, and he needed someone to do the voiceover, and Peter Christopherson from Coil was directing the videos. So both of those bands I was huge fans of, so I, of course, jumped at the opportunity to go up and do it. And the videos were banned by the record company because there are people being skinned alive while they're being hung and having their teeth ripped out and, like, water pipes that go down three floors and down these intricate hallways end up being taped and bolted into someone's mouth and water spurting out. And I mean, it's really crazy violent, you know, just like Trent Reznor, just taking stuff out to the extreme, into the edge and push it. And I think the most ironic thing about that was is doing that, and you know, and a really nice house, and they just had me do it in the bathroom, and you know, had these great sounds and echoes and whatnot, and then they had me come back and watch the video footage later of what I matched up, because they would just say you're choking on gasoline, or now you're getting your teeth pulled, or you know, so I wasn't really, you know, they'd only show me a clip.
And then so you were in there doing voiceover kind of work. You were doing all the sound effects?
No, it was using all the voices, and then they would show me the clip, and I would do more of the voices. And after a couple hours, they brought me in to show me, and they kind of clipped it all temporarily together and just said, so, Jimmy, how's it feel to do this in the house that the Mansons murdered the Tates in? Not good. Not good. I'm all of a sudden, hey, you know that, you did such a great job, and they're watching the video, and they're laughing, and I'm really, and it was great, because I'm sure they got the laugh out of it, too. It really began to creep me out. I was like, Jimmy, would you like to stay for turkey dinner? It's getting dark. You know, on second thought, I think I'm going to leave this house and never come back. Ever.
So it was the actual house where the murders had taken place?
Yeah, it was the actual on Cielo Drive, right before they ripped it down.
Wow, unreal. And how long ago did they do that?
I did it in 93, so I think it was ripped maybe a year or two later. I know they built another house on the same lot that someone lives in. Because I saw.
What were you, like six? You look like you're 19. How could you have been that old, 92, to have been working on this stuff?
Yeah, no, I'm actually 36.
Really?
Yeah, 36. So at the time, I was 20? I think around 19 or 20. Yeah, 19. And, yeah, it was, for me, something I just kind of never forgot. It's always kind of held on to me in the back of my head and my psyche. And I remember actually watching Ghost Hunters, and they went to that house on the same land. And the voice recordings they got from that is the creepiest voice recordings I've ever heard. And I'll tell you that easily a part of it is because I was there.
Really? Now, during when they were doing the recordings for Trent Reznor, were you guys picking up any strange things in the house, any kind of weird energy yourself, or did you guys get anything on playback?
I'm not aware of it because I wasn't working on... He was more recording on the album, Downward Spiral, at the time, so I'm not really so sure about what they got or what they had received, but from what I've heard from people down the line that know them, that it kind of got weird towards the end.
Wow, very
even,
cool.
Even for them, it got weird.
Well, I want to thank you for spending some time with us. What other projects you have coming up, and do you have any websites people can check out?
I have quite a few projects, actually. I have the film Evolution, that's sort of an alien zombie film. Then I did another film after that called The Black Waters of Echo's Pond, about 9 friends that go away to an island for a weekend, and they uncover this ancient game that sort of releases demons and begins to possess us, you know, according to our paranoias and insecurities, and then wreaks havoc on the island as well as on us, and has us wreak havoc on ourselves. And that would be Black Waters of Echo's Pond. Then just did another movie about mind control called Caller ID, and... And then I just recently wrapped Not Another Movie, just a small part spoofing Independence Day. And I believe you had a second part of this question. It was...
Do you have a website or ways people can keep in touch with you and find out what's going on in your world?
Yeah, the best way is to either go to MySpace, and there's other James Duvals on there, so I'm not on as James Duval. If you do a MySpace search, do a Jimmy, apostrophe... No, I'm sorry. It's Jimmy, parentheses, C11. So Jimmy... in parentheses, C11, and that goes directly to me. And then I just started a Facebook account, my very first one about a week ago. So you can find me on Facebook as James Duval.
Great. Well, thank you very much, and thank you for spending time. Hey, you guys, stay tuned. We're going to be back with more. We've got other great interviews coming up here as well. And stay tuned, because we've got the Crypt Keeper is going to spend a little time with us. You're listening to the best in paranormal talk radio. Hey guys, welcome back to the Darkness on the Edge of Town Paranormal Radio Show. I'm your host, Dave Schrader. Right now we're live at Crypticon over at the Radisson in Roseville, and I have the great pleasure of sitting here with one of my favorite actors. I have got to tell you, Mr. Shrandon, watching Fright Night is probably one of my favorite vampire movies of all times, and especially your portrayal of the character, because I just love the way they did everything. And as geeky as this is about to sound, I spent most of high school trying to figure out how to bite halfway through an apple because of what you did. Thank you very much, and thank you for joining us here this evening.
Oh, great. Thank you. It's great to be here.
Now, you've had the opportunity of not only playing an awesome vampire, you've also been in The Princess Bride as Prince Humperdinck, and you were also Jack Skellington in The Nightmare Before Christmas. So you've had a chance to kind of play a whole plethora of really cool, iconic characters. Out of the movie roles that you've done throughout your life, which ones do you think are the ones that stand out the most for you?
Well, they have certainly the three that you mentioned, Fright Night, Nightmare Before Christmas, and Princess Bride. I also did a movie, first movie I actually ever did was a movie called Dog Day Afternoon, which is a great movie. It's actually a wonderful movie to revisit because it really holds up well. Child's Play, the movie about Chucky the doll, which is really starring Chucky the doll. That was... I think, you know, a kind of cultural sort of, touchstone in a way for its time. So, you know, a bunch of stuff that I'm very proud of.
Now, with your portrayal, too, with Fright Night, which, again, I mentioned is one of my favorite vampire movies, when you were working with the character, I mean, that just must have been a kick of a movie to do just for what it was. And how was it working with Roddy McDowall on that?
Roddy was one of the great... sort of repositories of Hollywood history. You know, he went back to the 30s working with directors like John Ford and Joseph Mankiewicz and, I mean, you know, such an extraordinary career, and also the sort of person who was such an extraordinary friend that his stories about his life as an actor in Hollywood were always so enriching and so great, particularly, you know, if you're a fan of the movies. And he used to have these amazing dinners at his house where, you know, you could be sitting next to anybody from a, you know, Academy Award-winning screenwriter to Elizabeth Taylor, or, you know, it was just really kind of almost surreal in a way. But these people were not there because they were stars. They were there because they were his friends. And he maintained these friendships throughout his life. He was really an extraordinary guy.
What do you think sets, you know, a lot of vampire movies come and go and they don't make much of a dent. Other than Lost Boys, I can't think of another vampire movie from the 80s on that's really kind of set itself apart like Fright Night did. What do you attribute the popularity of that movie to?
Well, I think one of the many reasons is that it's a movie that has humor. It doesn't take itself too seriously, but at the same time, it is serious about the subject. It doesn't make fun of it. It has fun with it, within the bounds of the, you know, normal conventions of the vampire genre. And also, it's a hell of a script. It's a really terrifically constructed, brilliantly constructed script, when you think about it. I remember the first time I read it, I couldn't put it down, because the story just moves along. It's really just, and also it's beautifully shot too. That Tom Holland, the director, just had such a clear idea of what he wanted to do with the movie. The first time I met him, he described the movie to me shot by shot. And I think that kind of planning meticulousness, plus he required the actors to have a real strong sense of who their characters were, not only from the standpoint of where they existed in the script itself, but also what their backgrounds were. And he really hired, and he also hired very good actors to do the picture. That is, he didn't just go for a look. He also went for somebody, for the actors who knew what they were doing. So I think the combination of all those factors go together to make it, you know, kind of a touchstone movie for this kind of picture.
Well, I know, and this one doesn't really fit in the horror or sci-fi genre, but more in fantasy. Princess Bride, again, that just looks like, with the cast that you had, I mean, what an amazing group of characters to pull together under one roof and to do this movie. Was it half as fun? I know I've been on movie sets and TV sets watching it, and it can be very tedious, but just the cast of characters and everybody's personality look like they get along. Was it a fun environment to be a part of for the movie?
Oh, yeah, very. It was, first of all, the first 6 weeks that we shot the picture, we were shooting up in the north of England, and we were kind of isolated up there, so we hung out together. We spent, you know, breakfast, lunch, and dinner together. We hung out together at night. We were in a hotel all in the same place. There wasn't much to do. And at the time, I didn't have my family with me. Most of the others didn't either. Most people waited until we got to London, where you could actually, you know, rent a place where you could actually let your kids run around or whatever. So it was very collegial and collaborative and at the same time fun. But there wasn't a lot of, I mean, the script was the script. The script is a great script. Talk about another terrific screenplay.
Now, did you think when you were filming that, because you watch it, you know, when I first came out, it seemed just like a silly throwaway kids movie. But this movie seems to transcend every age group. I don't know anybody that doesn't just love The Princess Bride. Did you realize when you guys were being a part of this, when you were filming it at first, it was going to have this kind of cultural impact?
Well, there's no way to plan ahead for that kind of afterlife, you know. The movie itself was, you know, you knew when we knew when we were doing it that it was special, but, you know, when the movie first came out, it wasn't a big hit. The studio couldn't quite figure out how to sell it. Was it an adventure? Was it a love story? Was it a comedy? And the fact is that it's all of those things, as well as a very, very kind of witty take on that sort of story, that genre of story. So at the time, you know, there's no way to know what kind of life. It's like Nightmare Before Christmas, the same thing. The movie wasn't a big hit when it came out, and it's had an afterlife because it has a kind of resonance with people. It's also, as with Nightmare, the kind of movie that parents can watch with children and get a sort of totally different take on it, notice different things, have a different, there's a different kind of sense of humor as you get older. You get the more ironic kinds of liberties that the scripts take. They both are, actually, it's interesting that I've never really thought of the parallels here, but they both have had the same kind of life, afterlife, and for similar reasons, that people have discovered them when they're young, and they become richer as they watch them and get older.
you know, you just touched on Nightmare Before Christmas. Now, what I thought was interesting, I had always assumed, and I apologize for my ignorance on this, that it was, I used to see Danny Elfman's voice for the song, and I didn't realize that you did the speaking voice. Did they pick you because your voice matched what his singing voice sounded like? Is that how they did it, or was it kind of a mishmash as it went along?
Well, no, the songs were all recorded and animated, for that matter, by the time that I went into audition. And I think they were looking for somebody who could both embody Jack and also somebody who had the same kind of voice that Danny had, the same kind of, you know, vocal timbre that his voice has.
Did you reach, you know, a lot of the people that we talk to that do voiceovers reach in and they find a character from something from their youth or from their past. You did such a great job of making him just sound so in awe of everything that he saw. I mean, was it trying to just grab the inner child in you again, or were you just as fascinated watching what they were creating the story plot of?
Well, that's Jack. You know, he's the sort of wide-eyed optimist in all of us, and I think maybe that's one of the reasons why the character is so endured. And also, I was taking a cue from Danny because he did such a brilliant job with the songs. And Tim did such an amazing job conceptualizing the character that it wasn't hard to just sort of slip right in there and, you know, play the guy.
Was there, I know a lot of animation characters, you'll see, you know, parts of the human that portrayed them in the you know, cartoon lab come through. Unfortunately, your character's a skeleton, but do you see mannerisms and things that you did in doing the vocals come through on the film?
Actually, yeah, some of it. They always do a recording while you're actually doing the animation so that the animators can have a kind of visual guide. It's a bit different with stop action because they're not actually drawing to the face, because each expression is a combination of, you know, they had 400 different heads for Jack to give you the sense of the expression actually, you know, by frame occurring. So it's slightly different in that sense, but they still use it as a guide. And yeah, there are times when I look, I haven't watched it that much, but when I do look, I go, oh yeah, I remember that.
Ladies and gentlemen, we've been spending some time here with Chris Sarandon. Do you have any new movies, any projects coming out you'd like to mention?
Television series on ABC, probably sometime starting the first of the year, called The Unusuals. And a film called The $6 Million Detective that I hope will begin shooting sometime in the early spring.
Great. Well, thank you very much for spending time with us this evening. Thank you all for tuning in to The Darkness. We'll be right back with more. Good evening. Welcome back to the Darkness on the Edge of Town Paranormal Radio Show. Hey, guys, like I said, we're out at the Radisson, at the Roseville Radisson. Got a great paranormal event kind of going on here with Crypticon. There's a lot of great actors from all different horror movies and genres here that are here signing autographs. You get a chance to come out, mix and mingle, have some fun with us. We've been interviewing a lot of the different celebrities tonight, so hopefully you'll stay with us for the last part of this hour. I do want to make a mention. We do have some tickets to give away for the sneak peek of Twilight that comes up this week. If you're interested, we'll let you call in right now. We've got a couple sets of tickets for Twilight. You'll be able to join Tim and I out at the theater. Give us a call right now at 651-989-5855. Again, that's 651-989-5855. I'm sitting here at Crypticon, and I'm sitting with actor Doug Jones. And, boy, as I'm looking through all the pictures, now I knew about Hellboy, I knew Silver Surfer, Pan's Labyrinth, but I'm going through all the different pictures on the table, and I'm just blown away by how many movies you've been a part of. Just in this genre, it seems, alone. Doing Hellboy must have been a blast to be involved with. And were you also in Hellboy 1 and Hellboy 2?
Yes, I was. Oh, first of all, I want those tickets to Twilight, by the way. I'm just saying. Of course, it's going to do me no good. I got to go home to L.A., so unless you have a theater out there. But no, Hellboy 1 and 2, yes. I was in both films as Abe Sapien, the blue fish guy, sidekick to Hellboy. Now in Hellboy 2, I also got to play two other characters. One was the Angel of Death, which is a beautiful sequence there. And another one was the Chamberlain, which is a doorkeeper for the elven king of the underworld. And it's a scene where when the prince comes home to confront his father. The prince is our bad guy. So if you haven't seen the movie yet, that makes no sense whatsoever. But hopefully will inspire you to see the movie now that it's out on DVD.
With a lot of the characters you portray, you're covered in a lot of makeup. Silver Surfer, Pan's Labyrinth, Hellboy, as we were just mentioning. How much harder is it for you then to act through that? Did you have a Broadway background? Because it seems a lot of stage actors really can portray the makeup characters a lot better.
Yeah, you know, I did start on the stage, as many actors did, but I also When I was in college, I broke into the art of mime. And not many people want to admit that they are a mime or that they even know a mime because nobody likes mimes. Yeah, the white-faced, painted up, like looks kind of like a clown, but he just isn't saying anything and has no props, doesn't juggle. That would be me. That's how I did that in college. That is where I kind of learned to do storytelling and create worlds with your imagination that weren't really there. And communication really is a full-body experience. Therefore, acting for me is a full-body experience. When you take on a character, he must emote and communicate from head to toe. Whether it's a guy in a t-shirt or a guy with a tail and funny ears and a snout growling at people. One involves a lot of makeup and one doesn't. So acting is acting to me. And I want to take on the character in his entirety from head to toe. I start with the same thing any other actor does. They're finding the heart and soul of that character. What are his motivations? What are his fears? What does he want to achieve in the plot line? Whatever it is. But then when these makeups come into play, when you're playing a creature from another world, or a man, animal, mutant, or whatever, I've done them all. Then that's when it involves more makeup. You're saying yes to the role. You're saying yes to like 5 hours of makeup to make you this otherworldly creature that you can't play with your own face. So, difficult? Yes. The challenge is that you have to become an athlete as well as an actor because you're dealing with, extra layers of latex foam rubber on yourself that make things hotter, heavier, more constricting. And moving your head from side to side might actually take a bit of a strain where you're actually using more muscle to do so. But the trick is to make it look like this is just natural and organic for this being. So, those are my challenges.
Out of all the different characters that you've had a chance to play, and you've played some really great iconic type characters, who do you think is your favorite, and what about that character really stood out for you?
Yeah, I love every character I've played. And of course that's the political answer. I love them all. It's like a father talking about his kids. No, I love them equally, but my favorites. I have a special place in my heart for the Silver Surfer, and I have a special place in my heart for the Fawn from Pan's Labyrinth. It's Abe Sapien that'll rise above the rest. I've gotten to know him so well over doing two movies now and voicing him for two animated features as well. He's charming. He's really intelligent and witty and has this clairvoyant power, which is great. But he's also got an innocence about him that's and a charm that makes the fangirls happy to watch a comic book movie with their boy, you know. So I think it's Abe. It's Abe, and in the Hellboy 2, we really got to meet and see so much more of Abe, with the relationships he has with Hellboy, very much more brother and best friend like. His relationship with Liz Sherman, also very brotherly, sisterly. So it's those relationships that really make our movie watchable and relatable to the audience, is because we're a bunch of freaks that are hidden away from the public, and we fight the forces of hell. We're the good guys. We look like these freaks of nature creatures, but we're the good guys.
Sounds like us in radio.
Yeah, you're not that freaky looking. Now I don't know.
Not that. Thanks.
Yeah, your listeners can't see you, but I can. That's just it. As we are freaks, and I think everybody in their life has felt like a freak at some time or another. I feel like a freak most days, and a movie like this makes it okay to be a freak, and it shows you that we're not alone, and that we do have each other, and that you can make a family out of that.
Let me ask, as you know, we're a paranormal radio show, and I was asking you a little bit about experiences, and not so much ghosts, UFO, things like that, but you were telling me about your belief in angels. Could you flesh that out a little bit? Tell me a little bit about the story that brought you into that.
Yeah, I'm a good church-going boy. I always have been since I was a kid. And I do believe that God does have these angels that do lots of work for him and for us. Yeah, when I was about 16 years old, I hadn't had my driver's license for very long, and I was driving at night on a two-lane highway in Indianapolis, Indiana, where I grew up. It's dark out, and I was fiddling with the radio and doing what 16-year-olds do when they're driving by themselves in a car, whatever that is, not paying attention to the road, but mostly. And I'm driving, all of a sudden, my steering wheel is yanked to the right side. It was yanked out of my control. And I went halfway onto the right shoulder of the road. looked up to realize that a car had just missed me. A car that was veering, coming an oncoming car veered into my lane about halfway. I got out of his way just enough because the steering wheel was yanked out of my hands. So I believe that would be what we call a guardian angel taking care of you. So yeah, I moments like that. I also believe that angels come in two forms. Yes, the kind that, keep your car from careening off the road, and the people that God puts in your life at the right place in the right time with the right message of hope and encouragement. And I've had a lot of those in my life as well. You know, chance meetings that don't seem so chance after all, you know, where some divine force like pushed us together to where it's like, wow, I really needed you today. Thank you for being here, you know, is what I end up feeling. So I do feel very watched over and very taken care of that way.
Very cool. Now, doing these films and all of these different supernatural feels to them, have you ever had any weird experiences on the set or been had any of that happen to you?
I have not, oddly enough, no. But and I think that's why I enjoy playing fantastical, otherworldly characters so much and being in these fantasy movies is because the rarity of these occurrences. Now when you watch a movie, you get to have an hour and a half or 2 hours of those occurrences. So it's a great place to escape into and to look at all, and to actually imagine what all the possibilities might be.
Well, you certainly must have a guardian angel watching over you because you've been in some of the best movies out there over the last 10 years. You seem to keep popping up more and more. What's coming up next for you? What other kind of projects do you have going on?
Well, speaking of angels, I finished a movie earlier this year, this summer, called Legion. And it refers to a legion of angels, and it's it has to do with the end of the world. It's a big apocalyptic epic film with Dennis Quaid, Paul Bettany, Tyrese Gibson. I play a human being who's kind of been possessed by an angel, but I'm not quite right. There's a dark element to this film, and so that's going to be coming out in 2010, I think. It's got a long wait. Also, I'm in quarantine in theaters right now. I have a cameo at the end of that film where I play like I'm the reason for all the problem at the end of the movie. And I did a superhero spoof movie called Super Capers in which I played a knockoff of Agent Smith from The Matrix. That was a good fit for me and kind of fun. Also, I did a relationship dramedy independent film that it would kind of with a flavor of Little Miss Sunshine meets Napoleon Dynamite meets, you know, Juno. It's called My Name is Jerry, and I play Jerry, a middle-aged white guy going through a midlife crisis, and that whole time where you stop and take inventory of what your life has amounted to, if anything, and you that reinvention time where you want to do something that'll change, make things better for the second half of your life, and you come to terms with your hopes and your dreams and what they were and what they are and what they can still be. Yeah, it was good. And you see Jerry reconnect with a daughter that he was estranged from for 10 years. You see Jerry go through job change and reinvention professionally. And also coming to terms with being the age that he is and was he ever hip and will he ever be hip? He finds a group of punk rock kids by accident that kind of take him on as their special project to make hip. And there's some funny that comes with that. Yeah.
Well, thank you very much for spending time with us here this evening. We appreciate it. Much luck and success with the rest of your projects. You guys stay tuned. You're listening to Darkness on the Edge of Town Paranormal Radio. We're going to be back with more. And as promised, the Crypt Keeper is coming up. You're listening to the best in paranormal talk radio. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back to the Darkness on the Edge of Town Paranormal Radio Show. It's been going by fast. I'm live out here at the Radisson in Roseville. We have Crypticon going on. It takes place all day again tomorrow. You guys are going to want to come out here and check it out. A lot of great celebrities, a lot of cool people. Get some autographs, get your pictures taken with them. But we've saved the best for last, folks. I've been waiting to meet this guy for the last 3 years. 2 years ago when Crypticon first kicked off, we were supposed to have him as our guest, and something fell through. Busy doing some kind of Hollywood work and was too good to be on our panel. But this year he's here at Crypticon, and I've, like I said, one of the most excited to meet of all the celebrities that are here. So ladies and gentlemen, please welcome, for the first time and hopefully not the last, of the Darkness on the Edge of Town, the Crypt Keeper, John Kassir. Good evening, sir.
Hello, creeps, and here we are on the Darkness at the Edge of Town.
See, now that's the voice. That's what's got me. Now, when you started this, how long ago did Tales from the Crypt kick off?
I'm going to say 1988. I mean, you know, obviously Tales from the Crypt kicked off a lot earlier than that with the comic books, EC Comics, back in the late 50s, early 60s. Tales from the Crypt, Two-Fisted Tales, Tales from the Vault, you know, the EC Comics that William Gaines had the rights to these comic books that his dad had started, essentially what is the comic book today. And then, of course, they came out with Mad Magazine. The comic books were kind of controversial back then because, you know, kids loved them. Obviously, we know that they don't really, they're not really detrimental to a kid's psyche or anything because, but they thought that back then. You know, obviously kids can distinguish, most kids that are into that will distinguish between the fantasy element of it and the reality element of it. And, you know, so there were all these groups of moms and stuff that had started this whole campaign to get them banned because they thought they added to the to children's juvenile delinquency. And so, you know, I had those comic books when I was a kid. My mom took them away from me. And they'd be worth a lot today, Mom, especially since I could sign them.
No doubt. Now, did you start off in this field as an actor? Were you on Broadway? Did you start just doing voiceover? Where did you come in?
You know, I was an actor in the theater for many years. You know, many years. I was still very young when I started Tales from the Crypt. But I was doing some theater off Broadway and then had started establishing myself as a stand-up comedian. And I would do a lot of voices in my act and characters and that kind of thing. I started getting asked to do different, you know, cartoon voiceovers and that kind of thing. And had won Star Search as a stand-up comedian back in 1985. And was asked to come in and audition for this. And went down to Kevin Yeager's studio, who was creating the monster at the time, and you know, the Crypt Keeper in his shop, and I got the job.
A lot of the people that get involved in doing voiceover work, they seem to call a lot of their voices from childhood, from other TV shows, other characters that they grew up watching. And I know, like talking to Dan Castellaneta, who does Homer Simpson and quite a few of the different characters on The Simpsons Show, he got Homer from the Blob from an old TV show, Dirty Dragon in Chicago, and based Krusty the Clown on the raspy voice Bozo we grew up with in Chicago. I gotta know, where the hell do you come up with the Crypt Keeper voice? That's like one of the most insane voices I've ever heard.
Really, the Crypt Keeper I got from the look of the Crypt Keeper, because when I auditioned for it, they invited me down to Kevin Yeager's studio, who was, you know, building him in his studio, and they had a little sound set up, and I noticed that he had these holes in his throat and his rotting teeth, and, you know, of course, I'm thinking, in retrospect, okay, you know, I realized he needed to have some kind of comic timing to him, you know, like your classic, you know, Henny Youngman type comedian. And then, of course, he had this cackling laugh, which, you know, I'm thinking, okay, Margaret Hamilton as the Wicked Witch of the West. And, you know, and then he's, of course, telling the story like the old Hitchcock Presents or Rod Serling before Twilight Zone. And once I, you know, started putting those kind of sensibilities together, you know, I had the personality for him, but the actual voice was just on what I felt fit him physically when I saw him, you know, when I saw the puppet. So it was kind of like a great idea for them to have the auditions down there at the studio.
Were you up against anybody else at the time for it, or were you kind of the choice that they'd gone with?
Well, when I came in and did the voice, there was no other choice. I mean, you know, the next day I was doing it for Richard Donner and Joel Silver in their office and got the job pretty much almost immediately. But they, of course, had other people audition for it. I know, you know, I don't remember all the exact guys, but I think like maybe Michael Winslow, who does all the sound effects, and Charlie Flesher and people like that. Jim Cummings, who's a great voiceover guy, you know. These guys, you know, because they wanted somebody who was an actor and a comedian, you know, that had great timing and that kind of thing. They didn't just want to get a voice for it. They wanted somebody who was going to infuse the actual personality into it, because at that point, they didn't know, you know, what it was what it was going to be that was going to exude from the look of the guy. He could be kind of demonic. He could be a lot of different things. But to me, you know, having grown up with the comic books and stuff, I kind of felt like I had a feel for it. And that, you know, this guy had to enjoy himself way too much. And it's the only way you can get away with saying puns like that is just to really love saying them, you know?
How much of that was you? Did you help to write a lot of the one-liners and zingers?
Obviously, these guys, they've had a lot of writers over the years. And I've gotten a lot of material put in front of me for various things because very often you'll get copyright from, from copywriters that are writing for advertisements and stuff like that they've... you know, license the Crypt Keeper to do. So there's all these different people that have written for the Crypt Keeper, and some people are really good at it, some people are not so good at it. It can be really forced if it's not written well. The guys that were associated with Tales from the Crypt, Gil Adler and Alan Katz, and these guys were writing great stuff. And of course, that would inspire me to start making up stuff on my own and improvising and, you know, saying stuff like, you know, "That's what I love, a girl who give you head and that you keep it." You know, which of course I thought would never wind up on the show. But of course they did. They put him in bed with a, you know, a dead woman and her head falls off into his lap and then he delivers that line. So, and then I would make them laugh by doing, okay, Crypt Keeper as John Wayne or, you know, that kind of thing. And before I knew it, they were writing that kind of stuff. I came in and they had written this whole thing where the Crypt Keeper was, you know, Marlon Brando in a torn, with that skinny little bony body and a torn t-shirt, you know, yelling up at a balcony, "Stella, Stella," you know. I really can't claim that I wrote stuff as much as was able to improvise some of the stuff on my own, but also, you know, filing away all the stuff that they would say and have conversations as the Crypt Keeper. Because very often I would have to do live interviews as the Crypt Keeper. You know, like all our EPKs and all the different satellite interviews that you would see for different movies and stuff like that. You would see the Crypt Keeper, but I would be off camera answering the questions, and the puppeteers would be watching me and furiously trying to keep up. And they were really good at it. You know, eventually they made some kind of technology where when I spoke, the mouth moved, not as well as the puppeteers could make it move, but moved with how I was speaking, which was kind of cool, but a great kind of piece of technology. But the puppeteers were really good at it. And
I'm just curious, too, with this work, I mean, does it, doing radio, you get to unleash and kind of be what you want behind the microphone. I can be as animated or as lethargic as I want. When you start getting into the voices and, you know, doing Buster Bunny as well, I mean, do you just kind of get into the role of those characters and start acting goofy when you're in the studio recording?
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, it can be long and tedious if you just thought of it as a voice, you know, I mean, because the voice just doing a voice doesn't come across when you're doing anything voiceover-wise. You know, any of those guys that are really good at even selling soap, you know, they're really good at bringing their personality to it somehow, you know. So you feel the smile, if the guy's not smiling, you know, you feel these things. So, you know, I mean, being an actor is a huge asset to being a voiceover artist. You know, the better actor you are, the better voiceover artist you would be. Not all good actors are good voiceover artists. Some of them aren't really good at, you know, bringing that visualization to their voice. And then there are other actors that, you know, that are really good at bringing their voice to the visualization of it and acting their way through their performance. But if you put them on camera, they wouldn't be relaxed enough to be themselves, you know. So it's a good combination. This is the perfect character to have that kind of combination of, you know, acting and voiceover talent and visualization that goes along with it. I mean, the puppeteers would sometimes watch me and pick up my physicality and use that in the puppet, which is kind of flattering because these guys are really good. So, you know, I mean, they're responsible for a big part of the personality of the puppet too, obviously, of bringing him to life. And so it was great to share that kind of, this one character with them.
Well, we got to wrap it up here this evening. I want to thank you, Mr. Kassir, for spending some time with us. And can we get the Crypt Keeper to say goodbye to everybody for us this evening? And thank you all for tuning in. You're listening to Darkness Radio right here on 100.3 K-Talk.
Hello, creeps, and thanks for watching Darkness Radio. It's great to be a part of your nightmares.